Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we'll have the latest on that massive gas leak north of Los Angeles, including legislative efforts by California senators and calls for accountability from Citizens Oversight, a watchdog group based right here in East County. If you're still drying out from the weekend's heavy rains, here's some good news for Lake Morena residents. San Diego is no longer draining the reservoir out there, and the decision to halt came after our investigation. We also have a special report today on several freeway shootings on Interstate 8 in East County. Find out what law enforcement has to say about these unsolved crimes on today's show. Speaking of law enforcement, the sheriff has withdrawn plans for emergency vehicle training in Ramona, and we'll tell you why. Plus, on our local government report, find out about some hot hearings coming up that impact our region, including a hearing on Sandag's regional plan and proposed changes to the county's tiered winery ordinance. The Chargers won't be leaving town after all this season, and Liz Alper has details on our sports report. Then on Tribal Beat, hear which local Native American tribe will soon be opening up a Tony Gwynn sports pub. On Green Scene today, hear about a big win for advocates of rooftop solar. We'll also have news about the seizure of 100 animals from a home in Lakeside, ranging from wolf dog puppies to bearded dragon lizards. Our newsmaker today is Richard Walker, a resident of Borrego Springs, a desert resort town that is running out of water. Just what are the options to keep Borrego from running dry? Find out on today's show. Then we'll take you on the road to the Desert View Tower in Hacumba Hot Springs, one of East County's quirkiest and most iconic landmarks. You'll also hear about some federal juvenile justice reforms, and then from Public News Service, learn why Iowa voters are grilling those presidential candidates about their views on Social Security as they prepare to vote in the Iowa caucus. Plus, hear how the sheriff's Swiftwater Rescue Team is gearing up to save lives in this winter's wet and wild weather right here in San Diego. Stay tuned for these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
California Senators Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein announced Friday that they will introduce an amendment this week to energy legislation on the Senate floor. The amendment would direct Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz to lead a broad federal review of the cause and response to the massive natural gas leak at Southern California Gas Company's Aliso Canyon Natural Gas Storage Facility near Porter Ranch. That includes making recommendations on immediate steps that could assist in solving this gas leak, as well as preventing and responding to future incidents. Senator Boxer said, "It has been very frustrating to watch this Aliso Canyon crisis unfold almost in slow motion without any clear remedy. It is time to put our brightest minds to work to analyze and make recommendations that would not only assist in Aliso Canyon, but would also help us prevent and respond to similar incidents across the country," unquote. Senator Feinstein stated, quote, "What's happening at Aliso Canyon is a very serious event, forcing the relocation of more than 3,000 families. We have a responsibility not only to address this leak, but also to ensure nothing like this ever happens again." Adding, "This amendment, which directs the government to look at the cause of the leak and the response, will provide valuable lessons on how we can keep communities all around the country safe from similar situations," unquote. Under the amendment, Secretary Moniz would lead an intergovernmental task force in probing the Aliso Canyon gas leak, including impacts on surrounding communities and the environment, and issue findings within 6 months with interim reports as needed to respond to the leak. In addition to the Energy Department, the task force would include representatives from the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, the Department of Health and Human Services, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Commerce, and the Department of Interior. The amendment also directs the task force to issue recommendations on whether to continue operations at Aliso Canyon and other facilities in close proximity to residential populations based on an assessment of the risk of a future natural gas leak. The Aliso Canyon leak, discovered on October 23, 2015, has released over 84 million kilograms of methane, a powerful greenhouse gas, the equivalent of 2.1 million metric tons of carbon dioxide, or more greenhouse gas than 440,000 cars emit in a year. Attempts by the Southern California Gas Company to stop the leak have not been successful, and many residents in the nearby community have reported adverse physical symptoms, including dizziness, nausea, and nosebleeds. The continuing emissions from the leak have resulted in the relocation of thousands of people away from their homes and livelihoods, the closure of local schools, and negative impacts on many businesses in the area. On January 13th, Senators Boxer and Feinstein also sent a letter to the Department of Transportation, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Department of Justice, calling on these agencies to assist the state of California in responding to the Aliso Canyon gas leak. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Verena.
Citizens Oversight, a government watchdog group in El Cajon, has filed a petition along with Consumer Watchdog calling on the California Public Utilities Commission to hold an open investigation into the massive methane gas leak at Aliso Canyon north of Los Angeles. The leak site is owned by SoCalGas, a Sempra energy company. Raymond Lutz, founder of Citizen Oversight, states, "The worst environmental disaster in California history is continuing to occur without any investigation by the California Public Utilities Commission." He adds, "History is repeating itself before our eyes. The CPUC has failed to regulate effectively, as demonstrated by the San Bruno gas explosion, which killed 8 people and devastated a neighborhood." Lutz says the lack of oversight and investigation by the California Public Utilities Commission is part of a pattern that also includes the 2007 wildfires and the San Onofre nuclear power plant failure, which resulted in bailouts of utilities at the expense of ratepayers. Consumer Watchdog contends in a press release that the leak at San Aliso has been handled in secrecy, violating state laws that require public agencies to operate in an open and transparent manner. Former San Diego City Attorney Mike Aguirre and his law partner, Maria Severtson, are handling the case for the consumer groups. SoCalGas also supplies gas for the San Diego region. The company says it is in the fifth and final phase of drilling a relief well aimed at halting the leak that began October 23rd and has forced evacuation and relocation of over 3,000 families, as well as pumping greenhouse gases into the air at an unprecedented rate. The company anticipates completing the relief well drilling by late February, if all goes well. A January 25th press release from SoCalGas states it has developed contingency plans in case of unexpected developments in that drilling. The company says it will shut the well down permanently once it is sealed. A statement from SoCalGas concludes, "Our top priority remains the safety of those working on the site and the residents of the community." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Back in February of 2014, we ran a story exposing Lake Morena residents' criticisms of the city of San Diego for draining the Lake Morena Reservoir down to a mere puddle of its former self. We also aired a radio interview with area residents and a city representative, which won an award from the Society of Professional Journalists for Best Talk Radio Broadcast. After the recent rains, the water level at Lake Morena is still only 2.6% of its capacity, but there's some good news for lakefront residents. Kurt Kidman, public information officer for the city, advised East County Magazine this week, "With respect to Morena Reservoir, the city stopped drafting water out of Morena Reservoir back in February 2014, and we have not resumed any drafting since." In our radio interview aired that same month, a city official admitted that San Diego had done essentially nothing to ask its citizens to conserve water before making its decision to decimate a lake popular with recreational users, eliminate wildlife habitat, and negatively impact the lifestyle and property values for years to come. The judges in the Society for Professional Journalists contest said of our interview, "This show serves as an important community service by hosting public discussions on air about controversial issues." During our February 2014 interview, the city spokesman told us the city did not intend to allow the lake to refill, but would keep draining it. Do you think it's a coincidence that the city changed course and halted the draining of Lake Morena just days after our story ran and our interview was broadcast on KNSJ Public Radio? This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ Radio.
This is Miriam Raftery with a special report on freeway shootings that have occurred in East County late at night that all remain unsolved. The latest car-to-car shooting occurred in January on Interstate 8. That brings the total to 3 in the last year and 4 in the last 3 years, prompting the question, is this stretch of freeway from 70th Street in La Mesa east to Las Coches Road in Lakeside particularly dangerous? CHP officer Kevin Perlstein assured us none of the shootings were random. He added that in each case, the victims and assailants are believed to have been acquainted, although in some cases only briefly. Officer Perlstein adds, each one of them appears to have had some sort of conflict, whether it was that night or some previous time. He emphasized that this is nothing like what happened in Washington, D.C. He referred to one of the nation's most notorious serial killing sprees in 2002, when two snipers, John Alad Muhammad and Lee Boyd Malvo, killed 10 men and women, mostly in the Washington, D.C. region, but also one victim in Arizona. Those killed by the snipers there were selected randomly at gas stations, malls, and parking lots. Locally, the most recent car shooting occurred January 11th at 12:50 a.m. on the I-8 eastbound near 70th Street exit, according to the CHP. A black Cadillac Escalade carrying two women and two men was shot at, resulting in wounds to the two women passengers, including one who was seriously injured. At least a dozen bullets hit the Cadillac, and they were fired from two guns, a .45 caliber automatic and a 9mm pistol, the CHP officer told us. Unless one shooter was firing both guns, the likelihood was there were two shooters. However, details about why the shooting happened are still sketchy, mainly because the victims failed to identify their assailants or even provide any information about the model of the car they were driving. Nor did the victims in the Escalade say whether they had any contact with anyone prior to the shootings, but nonetheless, Officer Perlstein believes that's the probability because the victims were at a concert by a rapper called The Game that night in North Park. He believes that one of the occupants of the Cadillac got acquainted with a person or group of persons at the concert, and at some point they were followed. The CHP is still investigating who was responsible and scouring video footage of the North Park parking garage for clues, but chances are this crime won't be solved anytime soon, Perlstein believes. Another freeway shooting on I-8 near Las Coches Road happened in the early hours also, back on November 5th last year. In that case, a Lexus was shot at by someone in an SUV in the fast lane, according to the CHP. Both the 43-year-old woman driver and a 31-year-old man in the passenger seat of the Lexus were shot and hospitalized with injuries. In this case, one of the occupants in the Lexus was specifically targeted to be shot, and the incident was gang-related, Perlstein says. The man in that instance claimed he had been shot a month or two earlier, but Captain James Beauvais of the Santee Sheriff's Station said there was no evidence of an earlier shooting in his district. While the case is still under investigation, it probably won't be solved either, authorities believe. Another shooting occurred on March 2, 2015, about 3:30 in the morning, when a Ford F-350 pickup truck left the Sequan Casino on Tejisa Road out in El Cajon and was followed by a dark-colored Toyota Tercel. The two vehicles first entered eastbound Interstate 8 at West Main, and soon after, the Toyota reportedly pulled alongside the pickup and multiple shots were fired into the truck. One round hit the left rear door while another hit the driver, a 50-year-old man from Spring Valley, who was wounded in his left shoulder. The pickup driver was treated at Grossmont Hospital, and a female passenger, also from Spring Valley, was not injured, according to the CHP report at the time. In that case, there is a description of the suspects. The two assailants in the Toyota were described as Hispanic men in their 20s, who may have been looking for someone who just won money gambling, Perlstein told us. The four people were seen having some conversation at the casino before the chase ensued, but it is unclear exactly what transpired. The case remains under investigation also. And yet another freeway shooting occurred on May 5th, back in 2013, on Interstate 8 East, near the State Route 125 overpass early in the morning in La Mesa. According to La Mesa police, a Nissan Maxima with two men were shot at by a light gray or tan sedan at about 3:30 a.m. The passenger in the Nissan, Zusha Brown, Jr., age 22, suffered a gunshot wound to his head, and he died at Grossmont Hospital later that day. The driver was injured but survived. After Brown's death, the Sequan Band of the Kumeyaay Nation, where Brown was a member and an employee, put up a $50,000 reward for information leading to an arrest and conviction in the case. The tribe later increased the reward to $100,000, but so far there have been no leads leading to an arrest. At the time of the shooting, La Mesa police said it was gang-related, even though neither Brown nor the driver, Malcolm Hune, were gang members, according to police. Lieutenant Vince Brown with La Mesa Police concludes, the case remains an active investigation, but no arrests have been made.
The San Diego County Sheriff's Department has withdrawn its plans for an emergency vehicle operations course at the Golden Eagle Farm in rural Ramona off Highway 78. The announcement came during a Ramona Community Planning Group meeting after vocal opposition from neighbors over noise, traffic, lighting, and disruption of peace and quiet in a rural community. Nancy Regler, co-owner of the Oasis Camel Dairy, raised questions over whether approval might lead to other law enforcement uses such as a firing range. Kevin Carey, a local horse breeder and attorney, also spoke against the project and promised a well-funded battle to fight the project tooth and nail if approved. Currently, the Sheriff's Department uses the parking lot at Qualcomm Stadium for training that includes high-speed pursuits, but interference from the trolley, other traffic light poles, and the presence of homeless people make the site far from ideal. Jody Mays, Support Service Director for Sheriff's Department, told the planning group that the department will initiate a search for a new site, and the residents' concern were key factors in that decision. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Tasha Matthews.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is Miriam Raftery with this week's local government report for East County. San Diego supervisors will meet on Tuesday and Wednesday, February 2nd and 3rd this week. The agenda includes some important items for East County. On Tuesday, supervisors will hold a hearing on improving fire and life safety services in the unincorporated county areas. And on Wednesday, consideration of SANDAG's regional plan, called San Diego Forward, is a late addition to the agenda. Wednesday's agenda also includes a public hearing on a proposal to raise the height limit for a portion of the Riverway-specific plan area in Lakeside. And then on Friday, February 5th, the County Planning Commission will hold a hearing on changes to the tiered winery ordinance after months of meetings with winery owners and other stakeholders. Planners will also hold a hearing on the Hoskins Ranch housing development proposed along a picturesque section of Highway 78 in Julian.
It's tax season, and if you are a low-income family or individual, save your money. The county can help you file your taxes completely free and assist you in receiving federal and state earned income tax credits that could amount to thousands of dollars in your pocket. Starting now and continuing through April 15th, more than 500 volunteers will help prepare and file taxes electronically at about 92 locations across the county. However, you have to be low income to qualify for this free service. Supervisor Greg Cox of the County Board of Supervisors said, quote, "We want to help low-income working residents claim their earned income tax credit and increase the amount they get back and keep." Spearheaded by Supervisor Cox in 2003, the free tax preparation services are part of the annual Earned Income Tax Credit campaign, which the County Health and Human Services Agency, the IRS, AARP, United Way of San Diego, and 211 San Diego conduct every year. Through the campaign, residents take advantage of the Earned Income Tax Credit, the federal government's largest assistance program to support low-income families. This filing season, you could have your taxes prepared for you, prepare them yourself with assistance from volunteer, or do them on your own by visiting myfreetaxes.com. To receive free services, all you have to do is call 211 to make an appointment at a site near you. Nick Macchione, director of the County Health and Human Services Agency, says, quote, "Thanks to the tax preparation campaign, our low-income residents get to keep more of their hard-earned money. This program is helping them to get out of poverty and helping our region to thrive." Earned Income Tax Credit is a federal program established in 1975. This year, California is also offering a state version to supplement the federal credit. The IRS estimates that between 20 and 25% of eligible individuals do not claim their earned income tax credit each year. Individuals and families who worked in 2015 and earned less than $53,000 could qualify for as much as $6,269 in federal tax credit through the program. California credit could be as much as $2,653. Residents must file a tax return to be eligible for both credits. Last year, volunteers filed more than 28,000 federal tax returns, bringing about $13 million in earned income tax credit dollars to local working families and individuals. The EITC campaign is part of Live Well San Diego, the county's vision to improve the health and quality of life of local residents and help them to become self-sufficient. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Ed Barena.
This is Liz Alper with a sports report for East County Magazine here on KNSJ. Chargers fans can look forward to at least another year of good night's sleeps. Chargers owner Dean Spanos released a statement on Chargers.com on Friday saying that the Bolts will stay in San Diego for the 2016 season. "Today I decided our team will stay in San Diego for the 2016 season and I hope for the long term in a new stadium. I have met with Mayor Faulkner and Supervisor Roberts, and I look forward to working closely with them and the business community to resolve our stadium dilemma. We have an option and an agreement with the Los Angeles Rams to go to Inglewood in the next year, but my focus is on San Diego. This has been our home for 55 years, and I want to keep the team here and provide the world-class stadium experience you deserve. Everyone on both sides of the table in San Diego must now determine the best next steps and how to deploy the additional resources provided by the NFL. I am committed to looking at this with a fresh perspective and new sense of possibility. However, Union Tribune Chargers reporter Kevin Easy reports that the Chargers have reached a deal with Rams owner Stan Kroenke that will allow the Chargers to move to Los Angeles, but there could be reason to believe that Spanos could try and get a deal in San Diego. For now, though, Chargers fans can rest easy knowing that they will still have a team to support in 2016.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. The Jamul Indian Village of California announced the first ever Tony Gwynn Sports Pub will open in its Hollywood Casino Jamul, slated for completion this summer. Tony Gwynn Sports Pub will feature an unprecedented collection of memorabilia from the greatest athlete in San Diego's history. We are thrilled to partner with the Gwynn family to showcase Mr. Padre's incredible collection of awards, uniforms, and personal mementos for our customers to enjoy, said Richard St. Jean, general manager of Hollywood Casino Jamul. Tony Gwynn memorabilia will be on display throughout the restaurant, including gold gloves and silver slugger awards, game-used uniforms, equipment, and more. Plus, there will be Gwynn's own narration on video of some of the greatest moments in Padre history. It's surreal to have the first Tony Gwynn-themed sports bar in our casino, said Michael Hunter, executive council member of the Jamul Indian Village. I grew up watching and rooting for the Padres, and Tony Gwynn was one of my heroes. It will be an honor to have his memorabilia at Hollywood Casino, and we greatly appreciate the partnership with Alicia Gwynn and her family. I am so excited to share Tony's legacy with Jamul Indian Village and the future visitors of Hollywood Casino, said Alicia Gwynn. Not only was Tony a great player, he was an exceptional man. It will be wonderful to have his accomplishments highlighted in East County. Alicia Gwynn is as beloved in San Diego as her famous husband from her charitable generosity and compassion as president of the Tony and Alicia Gwynn Foundation, a philanthropic organization dedicated to bettering the lives of disadvantaged children. Her work with the foundation mirrors the goals of the Jamul Indian Village's budding charitable organization, Acorns to Oaks, headed by Chris Pinto, the Jamul Indian Village Executive Council member. We are proud to join with Alicia Gwynn to highlight her husband's career and support their efforts with the less fortunate, said Erica Pinto, the chairwoman of the Jamul Indian Village. Our philanthropic interests align, and we look forward to working with her foundation to support the greater San Diego community. The Jamul Indian Village is one of 13 bands of the Kumeyaay Nation federally recognized as a sovereign nation. The Kumeyaay Nation traces its roots in our region back 12,000 years, long before the first Europeans arrived at San Diego Bay in 1524. The Jamul Indian Village, which entered into a tribal state pact in California in 1999, strives to provide educational opportunities, health care, and employment for tribal members to open the doors of tomorrow, according to a press release. You can learn more about the Jamul Indian Village at jamulindianvillage.com. The casino has met with opposition by some community members who oppose gambling and voice concerns over traffic and rural character. Lawsuits challenging casino construction have been unsuccessful, though some cases remain on appeal. The Jamul Indian Village of California will be the closest Native American casino to downtown San Diego. The Hollywood-themed casino will sport slot machines, live table games, restaurants, entertainment, and the Tony Gwynn Sports Pub.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
It's a big win for rooftop solar in California. The State Public Utilities Commission rejected large fee increases and cuts to reimbursement rates on Thursday, changes sought by the big three utility companies. The decision is supported by consumer groups, the rooftop solar industry, and environmental groups concerned about climate change. The commissioners voted to keep the current system of net metering, making a few changes for new customers. Allison Sale, an attorney with the Sierra Club, praised the decision.
We think it keeps what's working about our current rooftop solar policy. It keeps the simplicity and familiarity of net metering. And at the same time, it makes adjustments which are going to incentivize the smarter use of solar generation.
The current version of net metering is capped at 5% of the customer base. Once that cap is reached, probably later this year or early next year, any new solar customers will be charged a hookup fee of about $150 to connect to the grid, and they'll be paid more for electricity generated at peak hours. The utility companies say the decision means non-solar customers will have to bear more than their share of the cost to maintain the power grid. Sale notes the same type of decision recently went the other way in Nevada, where the PUC allowed NV Energy to slash the amount it pays solar homeowners for their extra power. As a result, several solar companies pulled out of the market and laid off thousands of solar installers.
The experiences in some other states like Nevada have shown us that if you make really drastic changes in rooftop solar compensation, you can completely crater the market. And that's definitely not something that anyone in California wants.
People who already have solar on their roofs will still be paid dollar for dollar for the power they generate above what they use, but the changes will kick in once a homeowner's system turns 20 years old. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
County Animal Services, while investigating a complaint of neglected animals at a lakeside home, found at least a dozen dead chickens and a dead rabbit, but they rescued over 100 other animals. In all, Animal Services took in 88 chickens, 7 Bengal cats, 4 rabbits, 2 bearded dragon lizards, and a wolf dog blend with 2 puppies. And no, there was not a partridge in a pear tree in that mix. The owner told officers that she knew she wasn't providing the proper care to the animals, but did not want to relinquish them, authorities said. The officers removed the remaining animals and took them to the county animal care facilities in San Diego and Bonita. The cats and puppies appeared healthy, but the wolf dog is underweight, chickens and rabbit are sick, and the bearded dragons were so cold that animal control officers thought they were dead before realizing they were still alive. County Animal Services Deputy Director Dan DeSouza says it's an owner's responsibility to provide proper care for all of their animals, and if they can't, they need to reach out for assistance. In this case, the owner failed to do so, and it resulted in the death of a number of animals, he said. Animal control officers have investigated complaints at the property 4 times in the last 6 years. 2 of those were determined to be unfounded complaints, and 2 others were resolved after the owner complied with sanitation issues. Now, the owner does have a right to a hearing to contest seizure of the animals, but if the county animal services prevails, she has to pay for the rescue and care of these animals. The department is also now investigating whether to submit a criminal case to the San Diego County District Attorney's Office for prosecution. If the animals do remain with animal services, they will be nursed back to health and then put up for adoption. So you, too, could perhaps own a bearded dragon lizard, Bengal cat, bunny, or another unusual pet. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part 2 of the East County Magazine radio show. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, my very special guest is Richard Walker. Richard is a resident of Borrego Springs, and we're going to be talking about a very important issue, the most important issue for the town of Borrego, and that is the fact that the town is running out of water. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, let's start by laying out the problem for the listeners that may not be familiar with it. Borrego is in the desert. It's dependent entirely on a sole source aquifer, that underground body of water that supplies all of the drinking water.
but it's one of several towns in California that has been identified by the state as a community at risk of running out of water. How much faster is the water being pumped than it's being replenished by the average rainfall?
At the present rate, the community itself uses a total of approximately 20,000 acre-feet of water a year, while the recharge into our aquifer is at a rate of only 5,600 acre-feet. That means we are overdrafting our water at a rate of 4-to-1. So we have a tremendous overdraft of our sole source aquifer.
Yeah, so they're using it at 4 times the rate that it can be replenished by rainfall in an average year. And, of course, with drought and climate change, the likelihood that we'll have more years that are below average is probably pretty high. So what is the projection? If nothing is done, how many years until the town runs completely out of water?
The whole issue has been studied very thoroughly over the last decade by our local water district, by the Department of Water Resources of the state of California, also by the U.S. Geological Survey at the federal level. All of the research is done. We know where we are, and that means that we're probably looking at somewhere between 35 and 40 years of viable water still remaining in our aquifer, which we continue to utilize at a tremendous overdraft.
So in 40 years, they could have no water left in Borrego. What about bringing in water from other areas? Has that been looked at?
That has thoroughly been looked at by the Borrego Water District, and it has been determined that financially it's not feasible. We wouldn't even have the number of population necessary to support a pipeline of any type. Mm-hmm. The other issue is that we haven't found anyone outside of the Borrego Valley that would be even interested in giving us any water. Everyone has their own water issues.
Yeah, or selling it. So if you can't bring it in from other areas, the only option is to figure out how to conserve, cut back, and use a lot less. Now, let's put this in perspective. In Borrego, I understand that 70% of the water currently is used by agriculture. Another 20% is used by recreation, primarily the big resorts and the golf courses, which, of course, are the lifeblood of Borrego's economy that's centered almost entirely around tourism. And the other 10% would be residential, small business, that sort of thing. Is that correct?
That's correct. The 10% of the local residents are the members of the Borrego Water District, who, in fact, use that only of 10% of our total usage.
Yeah. So now what we're looking at is the state is basically saying if these communities that are not managing their groundwater wisely don't figure out how to do it pretty soon, the state may come in and take over these water resources and basically do it for them, decide for them what's to be done. Is that a correct statement? At least that's one potential scenario here.
That is a potential scenario, but it's not about anything that would occur immediately at all. The state of California has mandated that we, among other communities in any similar type situations, are looking at resolving our overdraft issues over the next 20 years.
So the state's saying 20 years, but you could run out of water in 35 or 40, so that doesn't sound like the wisest course of action, maybe. Short term, the state has mandated 25% cuts in water, but not for everybody. Tell me how that's playing out in Borrego.
The state's mandate applies to metered or monitored water within the communities. In our case, that applies only to the ratepayers of the Borrego Water District, who use only 10% of the water. The other 90% of water users within the valley are on private wells and are not covered by the state mandate.
So agriculture and the recreational users we've talked about, the resorts, they can continue to use as much as they want with no penalty whatsoever?
At the present time, that's exactly what the situation is and will continue for a very long period of time unless there is some voluntary cooperation in that area.
Well, yeah, that doesn't seem terribly fair. Now, the Borrego Water District, I understand, has been working on the problem for a long time, and there's also a coalition that's formed, the Borrego Water Coalition. Tell me what they've come up with so far. What's their idea for solving this?
About 3 to 4 years ago, The Borrego Water District instigated a cooperative effort, or at least from their perspective, an attempt at a cooperative effort with all of the major water users within the valley. That included the farmers and, of course, the golf courses. Two members of the Borrego Water District also are members of the Borrego Water Coalition. The idea was to bring people together to try to voluntarily come up with a program that would eventually reduce the amount of the overdraft. During these last few years, all of the meetings of that group have not been public. They've been behind closed doors. Wow. And so the public has not been allowed to know exactly what the discussions have been. But at this point right now, we're hoping that with the state's involvement, we'll get a better knowledge about what the commitment of those other water-using entities within the valley are.
So let's talk a little bit about how effective some of the efforts have proven so far. First of all, as a homeowner out there in the desert, when you're told to cut your water use by 25%, that's got to be a challenge, more difficult than for somebody maybe in a coastal area where we get a lot more rainfall, a lot more cooler weather. What have you had to do to meet that 25%?
We've cut back on the amount of irrigation to our plants and trees. Within our home, we have low-flow toilets. We take limited showers, an amount of time with our showers. We're very conscious of water usage from our faucets, what have you. We believe that we're doing pretty much the basics that would be required of us or asked of us, except for ultimately completely turning off, I suppose, our irrigation and letting all of our plants die.
Yeah. I understand that the Borrego Water District overall has seen about a 16% reduction so far since the governor mandated 25. So everybody's cutting back, but maybe not quite enough yet, even for the 10% of the people that are metered to meet that goal. So obviously, it sounds like a lot more needs to be done. Even if everybody met that goal, you're still going to be depleting the water out there.
If I might, just if you figure out the math, the goal of the state of California is a 25% reduction in water in the Borrego Springs area. Since 10% of us are the only ones mandate, the bottom line is actually 2.5% reduction in water usage in the Borrego Valley.
So you're using four times more water collectively than is being recharged, and the state only mandated a 2.5% reduction overall. So there's obviously something very wrong with that picture. Let's talk about the other users there a little bit. Agriculture first, even though they don't have to do anything, have some of the farmers out there made efforts to put in more water-efficient irrigation or let some, you know, maybe some fields go fallow, do anything to cut back?
I believe the farmers have done everything that they possibly can. They may be trying to do other things. I know they've gone to drip system going way, way back.
And how much difference has it made?
As far as I know, it's made very little difference because the research has shown that the percentages still used by agriculture is still using 70% of our water. So I'm sure there's been some savings there. I don't want to put that down.
Yeah.
But it's very insignificant in terms of the overdraft.
What about the resorts and the golf courses?
Again, our golf courses are very lush out there. I believe the efforts have been very minimal. And the only thing I can say is that, again, at this point, the research shows they are continuing to use about 20% of our overall water.
Yeah. So the options are pretty grim here. Really, there's no good option. It's a matter of choosing between a number of very difficult ones. While golf sounds like a luxury, and it is, for the town of Borrego, these golf courses and these resorts bring in tourism, and that is the lifeblood, the primary source of the town's economy, as I understand. Is that correct?
Well, it's an important part of it. In addition to that, we have thousands of retirees, many of them snowbirds, who are gone during the hottest months of the year but come back.
Yeah, we should say the town of Borrego has about 3,500 permanent year-round residents and then many more who are snowbirds that flock there to these resorts or to vacation homes that they have in the area during the winter months.
That is correct, and they're a very important source of our local economy there. With regards to the golf courses, I'm not a golf player, but I am aware that there are many golf courses in very dry climates, in desert communities, in other desert communities, and even down into Baja California, that have reduced tremendously the amount of water they use by cutting back on fairway widths and other techniques. So it is possible to reduce the amount of water that they as well use.
So they don't necessarily have to go away to solve this problem. They need to just do their share, as the homeowners are being asked to do.
That would be a very accurate way of putting it from my perspective.
Maybe more problematic is the agriculture industry, which is using 70%, as you've noted. It's about 4,000 acres out there, and they're growing primarily citrus, palms, even potatoes out there. And they also employ a number of people. We don't have a farmer here today, but I'm sure if they were, they would tell us that if they go away, then you're going to lose some farm worker jobs and any of the other jobs that are related to agriculture. How large an employer is the agricultural sector out there?
We are primarily a retirement community and a tourist destination surrounded by 4,000 acres of agriculture. Agriculture employs about 100 employees in Borrego Springs on a year-round basis. Mm-hmm. Farm labor contractors do import some labor, additional labor at harvest time. And of course, there are families with those employees as well also. Mm-hmm. But from my perspective and a look at the community and itself, agriculture is not a crucial part of our survival. I mean, we were a community of 12 hotels and 8 restaurants and the Borrego Art Institute and the Performing Arts Center, and I could go on, that are supported by other sources other than the farming community. I think it's a smokescreen by agriculture to try to paint a picture that the entire community would collapse if agriculture left the valley. I don't believe that at all.
So the state's solution so far has been to say we're going to give these communities about 20 years to figure this out on their own. Meanwhile, we want everybody to cut back a whopping 2.5% total in your area, which obviously isn't enough, and the aquifer could be nearly drained by then if it doesn't wind up in courts and challenged, which could take even longer. Now, you wrote a very intriguing editorial that was published in the Borrego Sun, which is actually how we found out and invited you in here on this issue. Tell us what your proposal is.
Well, my proposal is adjudication. 22 other watersheds within the state of California have already had their overdrafts adjudicated by the state of California state courts. The state courts have the authority to determine the actual percentage used by the various users within a watershed. That's been done under 22 circumstances, 22 watersheds within the state of California. That takes any stakeholder within the Borrego Springs area with the financial resources to do so to go ahead and take and force the issue into the state courts for the adjudication of the courts. The courts would make that final determination, establish a water master, which could be our water district or whomever the court decided, to monitor the reduction and actually enforce reduced usage by everyone within the community and within the Borrego Valley, not just one particular part of the community or users, but all of us.
And how long would it take with adjudication before a plan would be out and you would actually see the water use enforced?
I think I'm very reasonable to say that probably an adjudication would probably take no more than 5 years.
So that seems like it would be a lot faster answer, certainly, and it would be a court making the decisions, though, not the town of Borrego itself. Has anyone come forward who has the money to take this into court and force adjudication?
No, they haven't. I wish I were in a position to do it, but they haven't done so. And our water district is very limited on available funds, even if the board were so interested in promoting an adjudication. So that's not going to happen there either. It would take a private individual or private funding to go ahead and do that.
Yeah, and of course the ones that have the most money are the resorts and the big farmers, the big agriculture, but they have their own wells and they're not subject right now to the mandatory cutbacks. So
that's correct.
Yeah, that seems like a real equity issue there. Now, what does your supervisor have to say about this? I understand that you're represented by Bill Horn out there, who's a farmer himself. What has he had to say?
Well, as far as I'm aware, not very much. I don't think that he's shown a great deal of concern about the overdraft with our aquifer, to be frank with you. That's all I could say.
How concerned are you about the future of your community? You've lived there a long time. How many years?
My wife and I have lived there for going on 13 years now.
Yeah. You must be concerned about the future generations out there. What do you think the town of Borrego is going to look like 50 years or 100 years from now at the rate we're going?
Well, at the rate we're going at that amount of time, it will be gone. I love this community very, very much, as so many do. I've been a desert lover for many, many years. And it's the kind of community that we hope will be there for our future generations, not for just ourselves. I've heard commentary within our valley about, or like, what does it make any difference to me? I'm going to be dead by the time the aquifer's actually gone. That's not the kind of attitude that I have or I think many other people have. We want to be sure that it's an experience within the Anza-Borrego Desert State Park. It is the focal point of tourist visits into our state park. I hope it's there for future generations and also for the flora, the fauna, the whole desert experience, which will be affected once that aquifer is completely gone.
Does the same aquifer also feed the Anza-Borrego Desert State Park?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, it would be devastating for the wildlife, the bighorn sheep, and all of the animals and birds and plant life out there as well if the aquifer disappears.
I believe so.
Well, we certainly wish you well out there, and we hope that the community itself will be able to come up with a solution. I mean, is there some hope yet that this other committee that's been formed may come up with some voluntary cooperation, do you think? Is that still possible?
Anything is possible. At this point, I don't hold out any real high hopes in the short term. I hope perhaps maybe in the long term that might be true.
Yeah, well, as someone who loves the desert and the community of Borrego myself, the many festivals and arts events and so forth that they have out there, I certainly hope they'll be able to find a solution so that it will be there for many years and future generations to enjoy as well. Listeners, we've been speaking with Richard Walker, a citizen of Borrego Springs who supports adjudication to resolve Borrego's vanishing water supply. You can learn more about the problem from Richard's point of view at borregounderground.org. And for other views, you can check out the Borrego Water Coalition at the borregospringschamber.com/BWC. Richard, I want to thank you very much for making that long drive out from Borrego Springs to join us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Hayden Parsley, on the road in Hucumba Hot Springs for East County Magazine. You can take a trip into California's past at the Desert View Tower, a quirky and whimsical relic of the past that is still open to the public here in San Diego's East County. Located just off Interstate 8 at the Incapa exit, the tower is poised on a rocky overlook surrounded by desert on all sides. Built in the 1920s by Bert Vaughn, a real estate tycoon who owned much of Hucumba, this 70-foot watchtower has become a tourist attraction and a local landmark on the outskirts of the small town known as Hucumba Hot Springs. Originally built to commemorate the area's rough pre-highway history, the tower houses a small museum filled with artifacts and oddities of California's history, including our region's Native American, Spanish, and pioneer past. The top floor of the tower is an observation deck, with a coin-fed telescope that provides a breathtaking view of Imperial Valley and the Anza-Borrego Desert, though now somewhat marred by a wind farm. In 1950, a gift shop was added around the base of the tower. The shop still operates today and is filled with an eclectic mix of items such as geodes, gems and minerals, vintage postcards, historic and travel books on our region, arts and crafts items such as handmade Tecate tiles, onyx bookends, musical instruments, carved animal sculptures, and more. Roaming this area of the tower are the owner's many friendly dogs that add to the rustic charm of the location. You can also get a workout pumping a player piano while listening to old-time tunes. While I was there, the wind was gusting. It was a bit chilly and I wished I had a better coat when I reached the top. The owner says this is atypical though and that it is warm and sunny most days. The proprietor, Ben Schultz, has many colorful stories on East County's history, culture, and colorful characters, having operated the site for many years. Boulder Park at the Desert View Tower was created in 1933 by an unemployed engineer, Merle Ratcliffe, who was out of work during the Great Depression. He sculpted reptiles and fanciful animals out of the huge stone boulders. I didn't get a chance to tour these, which will be an adventure for another time.
Juveniles in federal prisons can no longer be sentenced to solitary confinement under an executive order issued by President Barack Obama that also reformed solitary confinement rules for adults. Also this week, the Supreme Court ruled that an earlier decision banning mandatory life sentences for juveniles applies retroactively, meaning prisoners who committed serious crimes before age 18 must have parole hearings or an opportunity for resentencing. An estimated 100,000 prisoners nationwide are in solitary confinement, including 10,000 in federal prisons, though only a small fraction of those are juveniles, Among other reforms, the new rules also reduced the time any prisoner can be put in solitary for a first offense from 365 days to 60 days. Obama wrote, "How can we subject prisoners to unnecessary solitary confinement knowing its effects and then expect them to return to our communities as whole people?" Adding that such action can have heartbreaking results, he cited the case of Khalif Browder, who spent nearly 2 years in solitary confinement while awaiting trial for allegedly stealing a backpack at age 16. He was released without ever being tried or convicted, then committed suicide at age 22. The rules only apply to federal prisons, though the president has said he hopes to see states use the guidelines as models for their own reforms. Several states have already implemented reforms, including California, following a lawsuit filed after revelations that nearly 3,000 inmates in state prisons are kept alone in solitary confinement cells 22 hours a day or more, the Washington Post reports. At the U.S. Supreme Court, by a 6-3 vote, justices ruled this week that the High Court's earlier decision in a 2012 case, which banned mandatory life sentences without parole for juveniles, must be applied retroactively. That means that even elderly prisoners who committed crimes as youths will now have an opportunity for freedom, though not a guarantee that freedom will be granted. The Juvenile Justice Forum reports that the United States is the only nation in the world that allows juveniles to be sentenced to life in prison without parole. Justice Kennedy, writing for the majority, wrote, "Life without parole is an excessive sentence for children whose crimes reflect transient immaturity." But Justice Antonin Scalia, in a dissent also signed by Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas, called the majority's ruling astonishing, and the requirements to consider even juvenile killers for parole impossible nonsense. A brief submitted by states opposed to releasing juvenile offenders argues that doing so would undermine the community's safety and would offend principles of finality. But Catherine Mattis, director of the Tulane Law School Criminal Litigation Clinic, says some youthful offenders have matured while behind bars, adding, "Some have mentored younger prisoners. Some have earned an education and learned a trade," McClatchy News Service reports. However, the ruling does not grant freedom, only the right to a parole hearing. While parole boards will now have the review sentences, they won't have to give parole. According to retired law professor Victor Stribe, an internationally renowned expert on the juvenile death penalty and juvenile sentence, "And it would be very typical for them not to," Stribe states. Juvenile Justice Forum reports. Daniel McCalliar, executive director of the Center for Juvenile and Criminal Justice, hailed the decision as humane. "It's the right thing to do," he concluded. "The rest of the world has recognized the idea that it's not a good idea to sentence children to die in prison without any hope of release."
More than 9 of 10 Iowans who say they will attend a presidential precinct caucus on February 1st say they're concerned about the future of Social Security. Concerned enough that they want to hear specific plans from the candidates. John Hischa with AARP, which funded the poll, says the results confirm his group's belief that the issue is important.
"This is a critical election, and voters deserve to know how the candidates will lead. If someone thinks they should be president, they ought to at least be able to tell voters how they plan to keep Social Security strong."
The survey of just over 1,000 likely Iowa caucus-goers shows 94% of Republicans and Democrats believe it's important that the next president lead the efforts to make Social Security more financially sound. Kent Sovereign, AARP state director in Iowa, says a failure to act would lead to severe consequences.
"If our leaders don't act, it's clear. Future generations could see their Social Security benefits cut up by $10,000 a year by the year 2033.
AARP has led the Take a Stand effort to get candidates to offer specific proposals for Social Security. All but 3 of the 15 candidates have proposed plans, which the group has posted on the website 2016takeastand.org. Pollster Brad Coker says the results show younger voters are just as concerned about the issue as those who are closer to retirement age. He says that proves the message is getting through to younger voters.
They understand that more people are retiring and that there'll be fewer people in the workforce to support those retirees. As they get older, they're going to be probably paying a whole lot more in Social Security tax than they are now.
The Take a Stand effort was started in November of last year in Iowa and fellow early voting states New Hampshire and South Carolina. For Public News Service, I'm Jeff Stein.
With an unusually intense winter weather season predicted, San Diego County Fire and Cal Fire have doubled the ranks of Swift Water Rescue trained firefighters this year. Cal Fire team members and the San Diego County Sheriff's Department Fire Rescue Helicopter Unit are also working together in case they have to pluck someone out of the water from above. Firefighters warn there are many potential flash flood hazard areas inland, not just along the coastline. Cal Fire Battalion Chief Darren Hunt says, "We have just as many hazards in the backcountry as in the coastal communities. There's actually a lot of threats that people don't think about. A low-lying dip in the road can be considered a swift water hazard. The firefighters conduct rescues in the water as well as from the shoreline and are organized into teams. A separate partnership with the San Diego County Sheriff's Department allows them to conduct helicopter water rescues as well." County Fire Chief Tony Meacham, who also serves as the San Diego Unit Chief for Cal Fire, said, "We put extra effort into the program as part of the county's preparations for El Nino. Early last year, as emergency responders began to plan for what was then forecast to be a potentially strong El Nino year, there was a push to make sure staff were current on water rescue skills. Some immediately recertified their training capabilities, and an additional 24 Cal Fire firefighters were assigned to train. In December, Cal Fire San Diego Unit's HeliTAC unit, which is already in partnership with the Sheriff's Department to provide aerial fire suppression and rescue support, also began water rescue training with the pilots at El Capitan Reservoir. Prior to the training, both agencies purchased specialized equipment for water rescues," said Sheriff Sergeant Mark Johnston, pilot and supervisor for the fire rescue program. "In all, about 17 personnel are now trained, including pilots and deputies and Cal Fire," he said. Sergeant Johnston said, "It is necessary if we're going to get a lot of flooding. We have to have the capability, training, equipment, and experience." Johnston said the Sheriff's Department can equip two of their three fire rescue helicopters with hoists to do water rescues if needed. "In that kind of rescue situation, a rescuer is lowered with the hoist to pull a person out of the water and do a short haul to shore as needed." County Fire cooperates with other local swift water rescue teams as well as other Cal Fire state agencies for regional protection. The County Fire team is also part of a working group with San Diego, Oceanside, Del Mar, Encinitas, Camp Pendleton, Imperial Beach, and Border Patrol swift water rescue teams. Hunt said, "We are preparing for an active El Nino season. For information on how to prepare you, your family, property, and business for El Nino, visit the County Office of Emergency Services Special El Nino Readiness page at ReadySanDiego.org and click the El Nino banner." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barena.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, A.K. Jules, Brian Boyko. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.